Can you believe it's been 6 whole months since our last feedback episode and a full year since we recorded episode 1? So happy birthday to us.
Right.
Is there cake?
Maybe you can insert some like background noise of a party going on or something.
I'll speak to the Foley department.
Thanks. It's about time we tipped the mailbag upside down and see what falls out. I don't know if we have a mailbag sound effect, do we?
I'll add that to the memo for the Foley department.
Excellent. There's been a lot, so we shall dive in. And briefly, we'll start on the subject of positive feedback. So thank you. We had a lot of very kind feedback about the show content, the format, both in like standalone emails and messages, and also incorporated into some of the mails. I thought I'd get that out of the way up front. Thank you very much. We really appreciate it. But we're not going to read out loads of gushing, lovely mails, but thank you. We do read them. On the subject of the podcast itself, though,
friend of the show, Mike Hingley, contacted us via email to point out that the show artwork for Linux Matters, specifically on Google Podcasts, may it rest in peace, is still the old Ubuntu podcast artwork.
Ah, yes. Sorry about that. This is a byproduct of us hijacking the old Ubuntu podcast RSS feed and pointing it to the Linux Matters feed. So if you were already subscribed, then it should have redirected you and, you know, it all should have just worked and been nice, but it didn't. And we have plans afoot to fix this, but watch this space a bit.
Yeah, some of the podcast services automatically took care of things and some didn't. And we did look at this and there's still, I think, close to 1,000 people using the old Ubuntu podcast feed. And we simply can't cut it off because we like you all.
More accurately, it is close to 1,000. It's about 100 people.
What?
It's not. It's not actually a huge number on the old feed.
Oh.
We probably could cut it off. We'll do it carefully and with respect and take it out the back and put a bullet in his head.
Yeah, and thinking of artwork, Mike's brother is currently working on John Sterling's Super Spy. So Mike's brother is Dave Hingley on Instagram. So he created some fabulous artwork for us back in the Ubuntu podcast days, a fantastic comic of us as the Ubuntu guys. And he's now working on John Sterling. So if you like a bit of comic artwork, go and check out Dave Hingley on Instagram.
On the subject of virtualization and containerization,
Joe, not that one, sends us a lengthy mail with suggestions for Alan's server migration, where he planned on using Proxmox back in episode 12. Joe also sent us a video and blog post with some virtualization and container training for those interested. Link in the notes.
Yeah, I did end up using Proxmox. Shock. I haven't talked about this on the show, and the migration is not complete for reasons. But when it is, I will probably talk about what I did and how I set it up and how happy I am with it.
Cool.
I should be interested to hear that because I haven't used Proxmox in a long time, but my days with Proxmox were happy and productive.
Well, watch this space to find out if I am happy and productive with Proxmox.
I feel like I know the answer.
Stephen also emailed us with a link on the subject of me not being a fan of Docker, and they suggested using something called systemd nspawn containers and a link to a blog post, which is also in the show notes.
I love systemd nspawn. This is a fantastic suggestion. And in fact, I combine the love of systemd nspawn with GitHub Actions. And I have some large build jobs that I create matrices for in GitHub Actions to create lots of systemd nspawn containers to build across multiple releases of Ubuntu. Way more efficient than using Docker, in my opinion. I love it a lot.
Interesting. I'm still not a fan of Docker. I have used it a few more times than I had back in whatever it was, episode 12 or whatever, but I'm still not a big fan.
A different Mike sent us a comprehensive set of feedback via email mentioning to us that back in Linux Matters episode 13, we talked about FIDO2 and YubiKeys to type a password for you. I think, Mark, this was when you were talking about like how to automate disk unlocking. Anyway, Mike gave us some advice on using the FIDO2 standard for conforming to USB tokens, which implement the HMAC secret extension. This is a lot of acronyms and what have you. So I'm guessing, Mark, you may have seen this email. Did you find any useful information in any of this, and did you implement any of it?
I didn't implement any of it, but I think some of my colleagues in other parts of the world have done some of this to make their lives a bit easier, following similar security standards, but yeah, using physical tokens to do some of the unlocking for them. And yeah, this is to do with, I think, how it stores or generates the key matter on the device. There's different ways of doing it. Basically, it can just encrypt a password and then decrypt it and spit it out as a keyboard, but it can also do sort of generating a token securely on the fly as well.
Nice.
Different devices do things different ways. Once I better understood what the TPM stuff does and what it's capable of and what its use cases are, I realize it's actually probably not really what I'm looking for. But maybe I'll look at something like this a bit more in the future.
Yeah, I was at Scale a couple of weeks ago, and a colleague of mine, Cole, was showing me how he uses his YubiKey. So he uses it to unlock secrets and what have you. But I think the coolest thing that he showed me is he has his YubiKey in his USB port, and he just pulls the YubiKey out of the USB port and it locks his laptop. Mm-hmm. And inserting and removing the YubiKey is basically the lock and unlock mechanism. And I thought that was super cool. I'm going to pick his brains to learn more.
Nice. Speaking of hardware,
Tom asked if we have a link to the very fascinating dual portrait monitor described in episode 2. This is my monitor, isn't it?
Yes,
it really is.
So the best way to find this is to search for LG Jewel Up and you'll find it.
That's D-U-E-L, not J-E-W-E-L, the way Mark pronounces it.
Okay, if you want, you could search for 28MQ780-B.AEK. Is that easier?
That's better.
Oh, yeah, that's totally a monitor part number right there. That's what we were after. Also, I apologise to my colleague Graham, who has been triggered into buying this thing several times, but hearing us talk about this fantastic monitor. Also, I still want to. I haven't managed to get my financial approval stamped in triplicate by my wife to get two of those, but I really want two of them.
Also, on keyboards,
Mike Kelly mentioned the buckle spring snap, which accurately emulates the sound of an old IBM keyboard. It allows them to fondly remember the mechanical tick when using mainframes of old. Mike pointed out the snap audio doesn't work the first time, but does the second, and wondered how to raise this with the publisher of the snap.
I used to love this this snap called Buckle Spring. It's good fun. It just plays the sounds of the keys of an IBM Model M through your speakers while you're typing, which is great. If you turn the volume up, you can really annoy your co-workers if you're in the office, and your family if you're at home. And the answer is, I think it's Trevino on the desktop team who made this. I will report an issue, and hopefully by the time you listen to this, it'll be fixed, so it won't be a problem. Incidentally, Mike mentioned he was born in 1954, making him around 70 years old. I wonder if Mike is our oldest, most distinguished listener. Let us know. Show at linuxmatters.sh. Kenneth Ludvigsen mentioned that 8-bit do have some nice smaller controllers with XD and A input, perhaps a present for the younger kids in our lives. I think this was in reference to you, Mark, playing with games on your Steam Deck in front of the telly.
Yes, and on my Switch as well.
Ah.
I've had some success with my daughter playing games together on the Switch using one of the Joy-Cons, but she has a bit of a problem holding it the right way round, particularly because some games we have, she uses motion control, just holding it in her hand and waving it about. And some she's meant to hold it sideways and use the stick to move around. And what she tends to end up doing is holding it upright and using the stick, but the stick's then on its side and nothing makes any sense to her. So what I'm wondering is maybe a little controller like this, that which she can hold the right way round quite easily, might be a good idea.
Yeah, the little micro one is quite cute.
Mm. There's also a light, which is a bit bigger and more fully featured.
Yeah.
So, yes.
There's also a controller manufacturer. I think it's called GameSir or GameSeer, and they have an ultra mini game controller, and it is almost like a Toy Town controller. It's absolutely tiny, but I love it a lot, and I have one in my backpack when I go traveling in case I feel the urge to play a game.
Also in gaming news,
George Castro points out that on Steam Deck, you have to tell each individual game render natively in Steam, otherwise it'll stay stuck at 720. And that feature can be annoying on a console because it defaults 720 for every game. You can't yet say, set the entire thing to 4K, including games.
Yeah, I was irritated with myself that I didn't pick up on this when we recorded that episode, because on Chimera OS, which we use for our in-home games console, which you can think of as Steam Deck OS, but for a DIY PC, that's exactly what I do for every game. We go into the profile and set the resolution to native, and that allows it to be played back in an ultra-wide resolution, which looks fabulous.
Yeah. I was saying that there was obviously something I didn't understand about how the upscaling works, because I can have a game that's apparently running in 720 but still looks absolutely great on my 4K TV. And someone actually sent me an article which explains exactly how all this works and how all the different levels of upscaling work in the game with Steam Deck on your telly and what to use where to get the best effect. So we'll have a link to that article in the show notes.
Nice.
We talked a bit about local send in episode 18.
We did, and Jacques sent us an email saying that they found it difficult to get local send and tail scale set up. They have a mixed environment with Windows, Linux, and Android devices, and they'd like to connect them all together, including over 4G. And they had difficulty getting it to work and assigned an exit node to one of their Windows PCs. So I'm not quite sure how you do the exit node thing. I've never had to dig into that level of detail with tail scale. I'm wondering if maybe, like on the Android devices, simply having the tail scale app installed isn't the end of the story. It creates like a VPN profile that you have to enable in order to be part of your tailnet. So I'm wondering if that may have been an issue. I'm still using local send over tailscale across all of my devices, but none of them are Android. So I don't know if that could be an issue as well.
Devilkin via Discord mentioned that snapdrop.net is another good instant file sharing tool. There's no client needed, just works in the browser, and it's also possible to self-host.
Yeah, I've seen this and it looks quite interesting, but I've never relied on it. I've just used it as a curiosity.
We had some email about voice assistant as well. Paul mentioned my glorious Mycroft voice, which is available in Home Assistant near you. He wondered if Style TTS could be trained on my voice, which is something new, apparently. He mentioned that the original source material for my Mycroft voice seems to be unavailable, making improvements difficult or impossible. And he went on to explain that this might be a problem with a lot of these synthetic voice assistant voices. If you don't have the source material, you can't like remix and improve them. I'm sure there are some where you can get the source material, but I actually don't know where the source material is for my voice that's in Mycroft, because I recorded it via a third party and they gave it, I think, processed to Mycroft. So I don't know that there is source material that we could use. I would be willing to re-record it all over again if I had some time. And maybe for this Style TTS thing, that's the way to do it.
So coincidentally, I found your voice and I think I know how all of this is happening. There's a project called Piper, which has a whole load of TTS voice samples. And I was looking at setting this up for my live stream where I have an announcer talk through some of the like text prompts that the chat channel sends to the live stream. And whilst I was looking through it, I wanted a UK voice and I found UK Alan.
That's me, UK Alan.
Exactly. So the Piper project does have a current version of your voice in two qualities, neither of which is of as high quality as the current contributions to the project, but one of them is definitely higher quality than I've heard of your artificial voice.
Yeah, it's still a bit processed and still sounds a bit robotic and a bit too bassy. I would like to redo it at some point. If anyone has any suggestions for how I could redo it and not just submit voice clips to something like Mozilla Common Voice, but actually an entire voice, if someone knows how to do it, just send me a link.
I also came across Piper because I needed to do some screen reader testing for work to accessibility testing of Moodle, and using Orca, which is the built-in screen reader for GNOME, is a bit painful with the default voice because it's so old and robotic and synthesized sounding. And I found a project called Pied, which hooks up Piper and Speech Dispatcher for you. I think you can actually install it as a snap, and it does the configuration of Speech Dispatcher to get it to use Piper voices. So you could even have Alan read out what's on your screen to you, if you like.
You really can. I have sat here for far too long having Alan narrate my desktop to me.
Moving on, let's talk about comic book readers.
Gregory mentioned a paid Android app called Calibre Companion that may work in connecting back to a home Calibre installation. So I discussed about doing this, having Calibre running on a server and connecting back to get your books from the content server that it runs. And actually, a few people gave me other suggestions for ways of doing this. There's also Calibre Web, which is, rather than running the Calibre desktop application, you can run an actual web application which can read a Calibre library database and give you your books and let you manage them through a proper web interface rather than a dodgy VNC in a web browser, which I'm using. The trouble is with all of these things is my use case is the Libby plugin, and that requires the actual desktop application to run the plugin. There is also FB Reader, which I've used for a long time for reading ebooks and PDFs on Android, and that already supports, I can't remember the acronym, but whatever standard Calibre uses to publish its library as a server, FB Reader supports that built in just as its way of connecting to network libraries, so you can already do it through that as well. But I like the fact that when you run the content server, it gives you a progressive web app that you can just run in the browser, so I don't feel the need to then install something as well. Also, Magnus emailed. Magnus uses C Display X on an Android phone and a self-hosted Comga as a backend for comics and mangas. They're a big fan of reading in landscape mode with this setup, and I've used it for years now because, Alan, you were talking about having tried to read comics on an electronic device and never found something satisfactory.
Yeah, I tried the BQM10. I think we talked about this back in episode 22, so I won't rehash it all. But yeah, I couldn't find anything that worked really well, but I'll take a look at this. Thanks.
Yeah, and Dom also emailed us to suggest that anyone in the UK looking for a source of audiobooks to check out your local library. There's a service stroke app called Borrowbox, which allows you to download them onto any device. I tell you what, our library service is massively underrated, isn't it?
I had a bit of a look at this. It's a very similar idea to Libby, but has audiobooks as well, basically. Your mileage may vary. I did look at our local library. It didn't have much that was of interest to me, but it may have things that are of interest to you. So it's always worth checking out. If you've got a library card anyway, it's free to sign up.
Colin Coe wrote in to mention Audio Bookshelf, which apparently works splendidly. It's GPL3 client server, which can be easily installed via Docker, Deb, RPM, or something called NixOS. There's also a web client, and it's brilliant, according to Colin.
Well done, Colin, for mentioning NixOS. Gold star.
Yeah, and a few people actually mentioned some audiobook solutions to me, because I was also talking about apps and ways of getting audiobooks from my server onto my phone. There's another option called BookSonic, which uses the subsonic protocol, which is a music streaming protocol, but for doing audiobooks, and that has a companion app as well.
A lot of you seem interested in our discussions of the HP micro server that literally everyone has, that we talked about in three episodes now, 21, 23 and 24.
Yeah, and Dugai Code mailed us to say they may have gone a bit overboard, getting a full 2U ATX rack with NVMe storage and spinning Rust as bulk storage. So they've got a custom rack modified to the top of their cupboard with vents and fans and networking and patch panels. There's mentions of NixOS in this email as well. This is very good. I'm liking this section of the podcast. Lots of Nix.
It doesn't last, don't worry.
And they're thinking of migrating to something called Debian. I've not heard of that. I don't know what that could be. They asked whether we've used something other than Plex, which needs an always-on internet connection, perhaps Jellyfin. I've not used Jellyfin. I purchased a Lifetime Plex license years and years ago, and that's the only thing I've ever used.
I also have a Lifetime Plex license because I met the nice man from Plex. That wasn't the only reason, but it was a certain significant factor. We had beer in Prague, I think. But I have played with Jellyfin and Embi, the one that it was forked from, many years ago when we were snapping them for the Snap Store. And I didn't have a lot of fun with either of them, really. So I've stuck with Plex. I'm sure it's improved over the years, but I just didn't get on with either of them.
I originally used NB, and then I switched to Plex when basically they changed their licensing and there was no longer the, oh, well, it's open source, so I'll keep using it instead of Plex. Whereas Plex does everything a little bit better than NB did. But I've not tried Jellyfin for comparison. But I wasn't aware until very recently that Plex always has to have an internet connection, and I was using it as my, well, if the internet goes down, then we can just play stuff off our server, can't we? Well, no, it turned out that we couldn't. So I am now considering alternative options.
Interesting. I am going to highlight one killer feature I discovered in Plex just recently, which is in their mobile apps. You can link all of your like online streaming services, the likes of Netflix and Disney Plus and all of that stuff, including the TV streaming services. And you can make a sort of a watch list of things that you want to see. And it will tell you when the things in your watch list are available on any of those streaming services that you subscribe to. And I think that is probably the most used feature we have for Plex these days.
So I have an option for those people who want something like Plex, but offline. My son sometimes wants to watch a TV show that is on the Plex server, but he just can't be bothered to figure out how Plex works. And he pings me and says, can I watch this thing? And I SSH to the server and then spin up a Python HTTP server and give him the URL. And he just goes to whatever device he's sat on, clicks the link, and he's then in a folder full of MP4s, and he clicks one and watches it, and it works perfectly fine. So there you go. There's a rather hacky way to get a media server out of, and it's written in Python on your network. Works perfectly. Jonas Sink, or Jonah Sink, or John Async, I can't quite figure that out, said on Discord that their power supplies are one of the components that you should never skimp on in a home server. Components generally only take themselves out during a catastrophic failure, whereas power supplies are the exception. They can potentially take out anything connected to them, which is everything, up to and including your house. Keep it light there, Jonas. yes, this is true. This is true.
Yeah, as I mentioned, my workstation rebuilds were ultimately because of iffy power supplies.
Stuart Skelton emailed to tell us about the microserver he has gathering dust and pointed us to a guide on Hackaday showing how to install a modern N100 motherboard in an aging HP microserver case. Now, this is very cool because there's something about this which I didn't realize, which is that the way the microserver connects its drives to the motherboard is with this horrendous connector, which its primary purpose appears to be to slice your fingers into little ribbons, but it can also attach a few hard disks as well on the side. And I assumed that this was just some proprietary connector that they'd invented for this case, but it turns out it's actually a standard, I think it's like a serial attached SCSI connector. And someone has made an M2 SATA card. No, sorry, it might be an M2 NVMe card with this port on instead of having storage on the card, which means that for this build, they've got one of these cards in the M2 slot on the motherboard, and then they can attach all of the RAID array to it via this card, which I thought was brilliant. I had no idea that was even possible.
Oh, Stuart, the amount of time I'm going to waste doing this now. You've totally been nerd sniped.
You know, people have like stealth desktops where they get a beige box from the past and stick like an i9 inside it. I think there could be a market for stealth HP microservers that look like an N36L with like a 2-core dodgy CPU, but inside there's a, you know, a Threadripper or something lunatic inside it. I think there's room for that.
I'm eyeing mine up on the top shelf, thinking I should probably do something with that. Oh, Stuart.
We had a lot of feedback about the joy of code in episode 25. We seem to have struck a nerve for a bunch of people in our community who got in touch.
Jordan messaged on Telegram, who is by day a professional enterprise software developer, and they said they like working on small personal projects. They don't have to worry about Jira tickets and sprint cycles. They can try out new languages or frameworks that interest them, and they say this restores the joy of coding for me.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You don't have to do any paperwork for your personal projects. You know, you don't have to have a bug tracker. You don't have to use Git. You know, you could just put some files in a folder and code on them, and you don't have to do translations if it's only for you. There's so much you don't have to do for a personal project.
You don't have to justify why writing another shonky bash script is technical debt.
Yes. Although today, a canonical person pinged me on Telegram and asked me about one of my terrible shell scripts. And I said, oh, no, because they wanted a copy of it to do whatever it does. And I was like, oh, gosh, no, I'm not sure I really want to share this. I think I'll turn it into a proper GitHub action. And they said, no, it's fine. I use terrible shell scripts as well. And I feel so embarrassed by it. I'm going to have to rewrite it before I share it with the world.
Terrible shell scripts are the commodity of every CI/CD workflow in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like you put them in a YAML file and then no one knows that they're all written in Bash.
Or, I'm sorry, NixOS people, or you hide shell scripts in Nix expressions because it was too hard to do in Nix. Daniel also contacted us via Telegram on the topic of joy of code and said that when someone needs help and I can assist them, that is a joyous moment because it reminds me of how far I've come, and it's like passing a bit of my personal success on to someone else.
Yeah, that's what got me started in Ubuntu, actually, was, you know, I had a tiny bit more knowledge. I was one page ahead of some of the other people in the community, and people were asking questions, and I'm like, oh, I know the answer to that. I can answer that. And it gave me great pleasure to pass on that knowledge, especially when people tick the little box that says, this is the solution to my problem, and I get some karma or points, or, you know, I'm a sucker for internet points. You know that.
EDI242 also said on Telegram that they have not experienced the joy of coding, but they experienced the joy of woodworking. It's the same as the art reference. No plans, but maybe just a picture for inspiration. They build or carve or even just nail some boards together.
I like that. I like the idea that code is art. I really feel it is an expression of ourselves and that whether you're painting or hammering nails into a bit of wood or, you know, writing fast Fourier transformations, or I think they're all the same.
I have recently experienced the joy of woodworking, but not because I did any woodworking. Back in September last year, I presented at NixCon EU, and one of the NixCon volunteers made these lovely dark wood Nix plaques and engraved people's names on the back of them. So all of the speakers got these little wooden Nix plaques personally engraved. And they came back to NixCon North America a couple of weeks ago with the same engraved plaques for a smaller subset of the organizing committee. But also they make these 3D printed Nix pogs. And it just goes to show that actually the joy of something in the sort of nerd sphere of open source doesn't have to be code. It can be many different creative outlets.
I was not expecting NixOS Pogs to feature in this episode, nor any kind of Pog.
And Ross Mayer also emailed us and shared a lengthy coding joy with us, which seriously, Ross, that should be a blog post, so get on that. Anyway, he revived his Google Nexus 7 tablet. Goodness gracious, how old? That must be, what, 10 years old now?
2013.
Yeah.
Holy smoke. With Lineage OS 18.1, I'm going to guess that must be current because I don't follow those version numbers anymore.
It's out of date already.
Oh, really? How out of date is 18?
Yeah, I don't know. He did mention in the email that it's not up to date.
Okay. Anyway, it's running a fully kiosk browser app and it's positioned outside the door of his home office, showing his current status. This sounds like a much more sophisticated version of my slidey do not enter sign I have on my door right now.
Oh, it is.
And this relays to his family whether or not he can he's on call or not, and whether he's wearing noise-cancelling headphones. Brilliant. This enables his family, wife with a new baby, to know whether to come in or not, and more importantly, how loud to shout to overcome his headphones. Marvellous.
Yes.
Yes, I need this.
It's brilliant. It's got these big icons on it, and it's just left outside the door, and it's even integrated with all kinds of like JavaScript and Azure and all kinds of automation. So when he plugs his headphones in, it lights up the headphone light on the tablet. And yeah, when he's on calls, it lights up the thing. So it knows. It's like automated and wonderful. I thought this was glorious.
Yeah. Ross, you have a Hacker News number one post on your hands there. You should totally get on that.
You do. Yes. So we've left links to all of the things that you've heard about in the show. If we've missed any, then let us know. If you have any additional links you'd like to send us, then feel free to email us show@linuxmatters.sh or jump on our Telegram channel or on Discord. And do keep your feedback coming. We love to read it all, even if we don't read it out on the show, and it may be another 6 months before we do. So yeah, keep it coming. Thank you so much.